This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I'm Katie Rich. I'm here with Joanna Robinson.
Hi, Katie.
With Richard Lawson.
Hello.
And joining us, a very special guest, Bobby Finger. Hi, Bobby.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. As we were just saying before recording, this is so, so long in the making, because basically the minute that the first trailer came out for The Woman in the Window, I think, maybe even before it was on Netflix, I emailed you and just said, you have to come on. And we can get into why that felt like the most obvious thing. But we're here at last to discuss The Woman in the Window. This episode is coming out late because we're abiding the embargo for Woman in the Window, which premieres on Netflix this weekend. So we'll talk about the film, and then we will have an interview in the back half of the episode that I did with Dan Stevens, who is on the upcoming Amazon anthology series Solos. But first, we want to get into some of the breaking news of the moment as we record this. We're going to talk about the Golden Globes, but first, there's some trailers to talk about. And Richard, you wanted to talk about the Stillwater trailer with Matt Damon wearing, I don't think it's like cut off sleeve shirt, but like close to it vibe of like a Oklahoma redneck in France. What do we think about this new film from Spotlight director Tom McCarthy?
I mean, I think after watching Spotlight, we all thought to ourselves, he's definitely going to make a movie in which Matt Damon does Real America drag in a French version of the Amanda Knox story, right? Like, that just seems like an obvious trajectory for everyone involved. Abigail Breslin.
Yeah.
I'm told the French actress in it is from Call My Agent, which I've never seen. But yeah, it's weird. It's coming out in the summer. It feels like a big sort of awardsy movie, but it doesn't seem... Maybe they're trying to do that like help slot kind of thing. Mm. But, you know, the Amanda Knox story is, what, a decade old, maybe?
If not more.
And it just feels like weird timing. I don't know. Everything about it just looks strange. There, in the trailer, there are two very overt nods to, like, you know, rah-rah American patriotism. One, a shot of an American flag. The other, Damon's character saying, yeah, that's right, I am American, you know. So I don't know if we should be looking at this as, like, an Oscar movie, but the trailer certainly is trying to make it seem like one.
Yeah. I mean... I know that Tom McCarthy made The Cobbler, that movie where Adam Sandler has magical shoes, but like he's earned a kind of automatic trust to some extent, right?
Even that if was a documentary, though.
So, that's true. He witnessed it all happen firsthand. He has had to capture it.
Yeah.
I give him benefit of the doubt more than most people, I think, even though he has made some weird movies in his life.
I mean, the thing with him is it's so interesting is that he's like, he's such a, at McCarthy's best, he is this very like localized, lived in kind of filmmaker, like not just Spotlight, but like Win Win or the movie
Station Agent.
Jenkins,
The Visitor,
The Visitor. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. This feels so much like The Visitor, right? Like that's kind of the vibe this feels like more than anything else.
But like ripped from the headlines in this kind of very like sensationalist way. It feels like a strange kind of Tom McCarthy makes like the Dateline, you know, horror story movie, you know?
I just think Tom McCarthy makes movies about kind of how sad and lonely it can be to live in America. And this seems like the opposite of that. Like this seems like you said, like rah-rah, America isn't America great. And he's always had kind of a complicated relationship with America. He makes it seem not super great and really hard to find a place, a reason to love, you know, living here and living in your little place. So I don't know. That was the first thing that struck out at me.
Yeah, I think that'd be a nice thing to expect from this.
Yeah, and I don't know how much of that is like, yeah, the trailer being cut in that way, and that we should expect that other message to come somewhere in the film. I don't know. And I will also say, like, the other question beyond the Tom McCarthy of it all is the Matt Damon of it all, right? Because, like, I feel like Damon has been casting around for a project that will sort of grip us for a couple of years now, right? There's been a couple attempts that haven't really landed. And I like Matt Damon in dad mode. I'm a We Bought a Zoo fan, so I don't know. I'm kind of interested.
You bought that zoo.
I bought into the zoo. You know, what can I say?
I mean, the crazy thing is that Matt Damon only has like 2 acting nominations, I think. Maybe 3.
The Martian.
Oh, The Martian. So 3. Yeah, because it would be The Martian, Ripley, Good Will Hunting.
Did he get nominated for Ripley?
I think he did, yes.
If he didn't, then that's a tragedy.
He should. But like, he's a great, great actor, you know?
Yeah.
And he's one of those like handsome leading men like Brad Pitt, who everyone over the course of their career was like, oh, maybe he's actually a character actor, which that term has sort of ceased to have actual meaning.
You forgot his Academy Award nominated turn in Invictus.
Yeah, unfortunately, that is the third, right, that you were trying to think of. Not Talented Mr. Ripley.
Not Talented Mr. Ripley. Okay, Invictus, of course. A movie that we've all seen. And
yeah. Everyone loves Invictus.
Yeah. That's the one where he plays the golfer, right?
No, he plays the rugby ball or whatever the sport is. But like
the Legend of Invictus fans.
But like Ford versus Ferrari and Downsizing, like these were like these movies in Suburbicon, if you recall.
He's good in Ford versus
Promised
Ferrari.
Land, the weird yeah. environmentalist movie.
You know, these are all movies that like.
Well, don't forget we've got The Last Duel around the corner.
Well, I know, but like he's having a lot of fun in stuff like Deadpool 2 and Thor Ragnarok and stuff like that. And he's going to be in the next Thor movie doing the same thing again. Like he's having fun, but like these other bigger movies that like, I think are a swing at something haven't connected since The Martian, which was in 2015, not terribly long ago, but not terribly recently either. So
he was also an Oscar nominated producer of Manchester by the Sea. His IMDb is just really providing me a lot of revelations this morning.
And he was supposed to play the Casey Affleck part, I think.
Yeah, originally. I think so.
Yeah.
I'm kind of permanently rooting for Matt Damon, much as I'm permanently rooting for Ben Affleck. That's a whole set. Although I guess, Bobby, on your podcast, Who Weekly, you guys can't get into the Ben Affleck of it all, even though he's the dominant celebrity gossip story of the moment because he's too much of a them. But I assume you are thinking about a lot about him, too.
Of course. And so were Hoda Kotb and Savannah Guthrie. I watched him on Fourth Hour or a clip of him on Fourth Hour today. And he was asked what he knew about Bennifer's, you know, reconciliation. And he was like, he gave a very, his response, you know, showed me why we all like Matt Damon to begin with. It was very funny. He was playing coy. He was like, I have no idea what you're talking about. You know, like it was very charming. And he was, you know, zooming in from Australia, which it's funny to me that he's lived in Australia for this long. But
yeah.
I was like, oh, right. This movie looks not so great, but Matt Damon, I'm a fan.
Yeah, Matt Damon press tour is a good thing.
Yeah, I feel like he's always been so good at answering questions about Ben Affleck. That's like his superpower.
Well, we'll see how that comes together on The Last Duel when they are out there together. Real quick, before we move away from trailers, there was also a trailer for The Green Knight from David Lowery, starring Dev Patel and his beautiful hair. It looks kind of weird and like almost like Jason the Argonauts he made me think about with like giants roaming in the background. It's an A24 release. They have been good at like marketing weird movies like Midsommar and Hereditary to come out in the summer, which I believe is when The Green Knight is set for. You guys have any broader thoughts on it?
The Green Knight was rumored to be at Cannes last year, ahead of its release intended for last summer. So it's been done for a long time.
Yeah.
David Lowery is such an interesting filmmaker. I mean, he, you know, went from Ain't Them Body Saints to Pete's Dragon to A Ghost Story to the Robert Redford Sissy Spacek heist movie. I think he's a really fascinating director. Who keeps switching genre. So I'm really curious to see. The trailer is promising. But yeah, it's probably a tough sell. You know, we just did a post, or we have one coming up, that's like, here's a movie to see in the theater every week for the whole summer, you know, if people are like interested in getting back to theaters. And it's like, I don't know how you sell The Green Knight as one of those movies, because it looks very, you know, esoteric. It's based on an old, like Arthurian legend, I think, about people cutting people's heads off and I don't know, but I'm very curious to see it. But it doesn't strike me as either very commercial or frankly, very like awardsy.
Well, I was just very, very, very excited for this film last year. It was like one of my most anticipated films because I understand that it might not be for mass consumption, but I do love this Arthurian legend. And I do love, as you know, Dev Patel doing anything. And I love the look of this. I loved Lowry's Pete's Dragon among his like other more experimental things. I think he does really like, he did that big, that wasn't a popular movie either, but he made me like weep in the theaters. And he does like big sweeping epic as well as he does these like very small things. So I don't know that it will be for mass consumption, but I think that like a lot of A24 movies, it'll find its like rabid niche audience. Do you know? That's what I think about this movie.
I don't know that I've cried at a movie as much as I cried at Peace Dragon. I saw a press screening of that movie the day after I saw Suicide Squad. And I was like, so like, everything's terrible. And then that movie, I just was like, destroyed by people. I think, Bobby, you like that movie too, right?
I love that. I love David Lowry movies. Yeah. So like, I like Dev Patel a lot. I love Dave Lowry. I will love this movie. Like, there's just, I watched the trailer and I was like, I don't care.
Yeah.
I've already decided I will love. I love The Old Man and the Gun. You know,
I love
these movies. I feel obviously this aesthetically, at the very least, just looks like such a departure from his other movies. But I still like, I'm so used to like wrapping myself up in a David Lowry movie and like feeling very comfortable. So like, I'm looking forward to like seeing if that's, because A24 is basically like, they're essentially just really good at book jacket design, right? Like they package movies very, very well. And I don't know that their trailers are ever good at representations of what the movies actually are. So I'm like, I was choosing to see what isn't shown in this trailer. Cause I'm like that they're trying to mess with me. They're trying to like make it seem like a thing that it may not actually be. So I'm hoping for that sort of Lowry-esque comfort that I've come to expect from his movies. But yeah, I love Pete's Dragon. I love Pete's Dragon.
Yeah, it's so good.
Yeah, I never do this, I swear. But after I saw A Ghost Story, which was his kind of post-Pete's Dragon, one for me kind of movie, I tracked down his email address from a publicist and emailed him just like kind of thanking him for the movie. I think he's such a thoughtful, sensitive, empathetic, or empathic, really, filmmaker. And I don't know how that aspect of his filmmaking is going to come into play in this, but I'm really excited to see if he can get that same kind of close, kind of human, really organic sentiment in a movie about, like I said, beheadings and whatnot.
Yeah, there's a big beheading in there.
It's potentially like a really sort of weirdly quiet interior spiritual movie, possibly. And I could see how in David Lowry's hands, like, it could be that. Because the original text is pretty short and pretty sparse. And so there's just like a lot of meat he could put on the bones of that. I want to like drink every shot of Dev Patel in this trailer. I think he like the design of him in this is so, and like he's such like David Copperfield, one of my favorite films of last year. So like I'm really excited. And I know we're not really in the habit of doing this, but I will just say, if you somehow didn't see Pete's Dragon, it is, you know, streaming on Disney Plus. And I promise you, it's so good. And you know, hopefully you'll weep, and wouldn't it be nice to feel something? So do that.
Yeah, I do like the idea of like going into a theater and letting something like this absorb you. Like, it's not a Fast and Furious movie in terms of like a you must go to the theater, but like if TV is feeling kind of formulaic to you, if you're tired of the walls of your own house, like go escape to a world with Dev Patel in chainmail. I see the appeal in that for sure.
It's giving me real, like, Fantastic Fest vibes. Like, I could see it at an Alamo Drafthouse in Austin. It's sweltering outside, but ice cold inside, and Dev Patel's there. So
I would eat the Green Knight theme meal, whatever it is. All right, let's pivot to the awards drama of the moment. The Golden Globes are not going to air on NBC next January, as you probably know by now. What led to it is kind of this long TikTok of scandals, some of which we've talked about on the show, probably some we haven't. We got a text, a couple of you texted us about subtext, including on subtext about this, including two in a row that just said, RIP Golden Globes. And so we're glad that you guys thought of us first when the news broke. But Narushi Hayasaki signed up for international texting to text us, which we're very grateful for, and basically just asked for a recap of what happened, which so our colleague Anthony Brosnahan, by the time you hear this, will have written an article that really nicely lays all of this out. And I'll crib from it just briefly. You know, it started, which I had forgotten, with Emily in Paris. Do you guys remember that Emily in Paris was the inciting incident of this whole thing?
Emily Domperie.
Emily Domperie. The LA Times article that basically revealed that Netflix had flown members of the Hollywood Foreign Press to Paris to watch it be filmed before it got nominated. And I believe the same article, oh no, sorry, a different Los Angeles Times article also revealed the real sticking point, which is that they had no black members, you know, of the 86 or so people who were in the organization. And then just all of these other smaller scandals followed, including the person who asked Daniel Kaluuya what it was like to work with Regina King at the Oscars was a Hollywood Foreign Press member, which I had not put together until this moment. And then Phil Burke, who was the former Hollywood Foreign Press president, called Black Lives Matter a racist hate movement in an internal email. Also not great. So it was just a series of things. And I think we have certainly talked on the show before about how the Hollywood Foreign Press has a reputation for kind of going after the biggest stars. And, you know, if you can wine and dine them, you can get yourselves a nomination. And for a long time, it was just this like thing that people dealt with. And the thing that has happened over the past few days, like, you know, Scarlett Johansson, Mark Ruffalo come out saying not to work with it. Netflix says they won't work with them. And it was all this, you know, escalating things that led to NBC not canceling its contract, I guess, but just not deciding not to air it next year and asking them to do better, basically. And I think the big question that none of us really can answer for now, but should certainly discuss is like, can the Golden Globes come back for this? Is this the end of the Globes, or do we think that reform is actually possible?
I think the existential problem that they face and that kind of we face as like people who cover all this stuff is like, even if it were to come back in 2023, as NBC has said they hope to broadcast the show that year, is like, we now really can't ignore the fact that they have been irrelevant and sort of ridiculous for their entire existence.
Yeah.
And I think that that might not matter to the casual viewer who would just tune in on a Sunday night to see some gowns and acceptance speeches and like, you know, monologues from comedians. But I think at its core, the show needed that at least kind of half serious pretense that they actually meant something. And now that it's just so apparent that they don't, and that also not only are they just a frivolous kind of throwaway thing, they're rotten, you know, like there's so many bad things at the core of the organization that those two things combined, the irrelevance and the sort of corruption or you know, various other ills, I just don't think that you can rebuild after that. You know, even if the show were to come back, it's going to be met with even bigger shrug than it has been before. I wrote something for the site kind of, you know, presupposing that like the Globes just don't come back, at least on like major broadcast television. Maybe they'll end up on cable somewhere. But OK, so what fills that slot? Is it does NBC steal the SAGs away from TNT? Do they take the Critics' Choice Awards from the CW? I think both are viable options, provided they can, you know, get that broadcast deal. But I also think that there are problems inherent in either of those choices, not as institutional as there are with the HFPA, but this really is about building a sort of regard and prestige that takes a long time. I mean, the Globes have been around for a long time. And even after those many decades of its existence, people were still questioning its legitimacy. So you can't just swap in something else and be like, now treat this as the second only to the Oscars. You know, that just can't happen.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is like a real Emperor Has No Clothes moment for, I just don't know that they do come back from this. It just feels the swell of lack of support, swell of rejection from these, you know, from people, creative people who have power positions in Hollywood. It reminds me of like the Me Too movement, where like when there's a certain amount of people speaking truth to power, and it's true, it's not, it's all true what they're saying about the HFPA. I just don't know how you do come back from that, especially if we have an awards cycle sort of without them in a big televised position, and we see what that looks like, and maybe we'll be fine, we don't miss them at all. I mean, you know, I think people on the awards, you know, trail every year do enjoy the Golden Globes because it's like fun and weird and boozy. You know what I mean? Like that's something that's fun for them to do. And there isn't really another award ceremony that's quite like that. But, you know, I don't think that's a reason to give them the amount of power that they've had for so long.
Yeah, we had two different texts from listeners from who had similar points. Marina Herrera-Heinz and Timothy Leva were both like, what does it mean that this is happening after the Globes were not in person and kind of had a disastrous Zoom telecast? Like, if they had just come off of yet another show where, like, everyone's in person, they all get to schmooze and appear on television and kind of reap the rewards of that, would things have collapsed so quickly? And I think it's hard to know. It's a counterfactual, but I think that definitely had to do with it, that we went a year essentially without the Golden Globes and we're like, hang on a second, we don't really need to do this anymore. Bobby, you're someone who is like watches the Globes, I know, and is like maybe doesn't obsess over it to the extent that we do. But do you feel like the fun of it outweighed the problems of it for too long? And that's where we are now.
That's yeah. I think because like you were saying, the Globes have been a joke for so long. Like if you've read anything about the Globes in the past 30 years, you've come across some sort of news item about how it is corrupt in some way, whether it's any kind of version of pay to play or something else. But you watch it because the hosts are funny. You watch it because everyone's drunk. Like, we understand why you watch it. But I mean, my first thought after seeing this yesterday, the news that they just weren't going to air it and that Tom Cruise had returned his awards, which I feel like is going to be, you know, the first domino in a very long line of dominoes falling with regards to people returning their awards. It just seems like the sort of thing that you do simply because other people are doing it. I was like, oh, cool. Maybe the SAGs will move to basic cable now. Like, maybe the SAGs will go off TNT or TBS or wherever they are. Because to me, I never watch them because they always sort of, as someone who's not a critic, as someone who doesn't do this for a living, the SAGs always creep up on me. And I watch the coverage of them because I know that they are this sort of like predictor of the Oscars, which I always watch. But I was like, I'd love to watch the SAGs. I'd love them to amp this up. Like, I don't think it needs to be replaced. I don't think they need to come back. Like, bring up one of these awards that is as a viewer, as someone who follows this stuff and reads this stuff, like everyone's always talking about the importance of the SAGs. So like, it's on me for never watching them, but this is an excuse to like, for the SAGs to shine, I guess. That was my gut reaction to all of this. I'm sort of like, there's a way things can replace the Golden Globes. You don't need to bring them back. I just think it's unfixable at this point. It's too toxic.
And the thing about the SAGs is that they, like, for one thing, any award show about movies, let's be honest, or TV, people are watching for the actors. And so SAGs are all just only actors. And it's a dinner, so you can get people drunk. You can do the sort of regular Golden Globes thing. You can have a funny host. You can move it from TNT to NBC if that contractually is able to happen. I think the SAGs is a much cleaner switch than like any other award show, like the Critics' Choice would be. I mean, maybe there's not time for it to happen next year. I don't know what the contracts are like, but like that feels like an obvious successor, and it would probably pretty seamlessly just take over the spot occupied by the Globes for many years.
And I would love that. I mean, the SAGs, that's a great show and also like a great underwatched show. And also, I feel like they had their quiet internal reform a couple years ago, if that makes sense. I don't know if you guys remember that, but there was just like, it was like a couple years ago where the SAGs were like, we're going to do better about paying attention to, you know, a broader swath of nominees. And I think they have since. So, yeah. Bring up the SAGs.
I'm obviously biased as a voting member on the Critics' Choice Awards, but I would make the case for that being the replacement. I mean, because I think you get a broader swath of nominees. Like, they have directing and writing and, you know, maybe too many prizes to air on a big network broadcast. But I think there's kind of a wide representation there, and you get them coming, like, after a bunch of the other Critics' Awards. There's a chance that it could, like, help make some critical darlings, like, more visible in the awards season. And also what will probably happen is both SAGs and Critics' Choice will become more visible, particularly because given the way that ratings are going for award shows on broadcasts, like maybe NBC doesn't jump to replace the Globes with something and the ecosystem just shifts.
Well, except that like despite sagging ratings, like previous to COVID, like the Globes were still a very watched event, you know, like all live television viewing is down on broadcast networks. You know, the Super Bowl just dipped below 100 million last year. I think the Oscars has always been the second most watched live event of the year every year. And the Globes was closing that gap with the Oscars previous to all this. So I think there is an advertising incentive to have something in that January slot. When I wrote about the Globes news, for the site, one thing I did say about the maybe self-deprecatingly about the, I'm not a member of the group, but like about the Critics' Choice Awards is like that word critics, I think, is a little alienating maybe to some people. And like, I know that the Globes are also awarded by journalists, but they kept that journalism job title somewhat distant from the Globes branding, you know. I think
they
a lot
had the
of
word Hollywood first, not press first.
Yeah, exactly.
And most people just said HFPA, so you weren't even like sure what the P stood for. You know what I mean?
the dreaded P, exactly. So I think that I think that if the Critics' Choice Awards were to try to move into that position, that would be something of a branding challenge, because a lot of people, perhaps fairly, perhaps unfairly, don't like the idea of critics, and why would they sit down and watch what critics are saying is the best stuff of the year versus the much more amorphous, nebulous Academy.
Branding challenge accepted. As a voting member of the Critics' Choice Awards, I would like to ask all of our Little Gold Men listeners to come up with like a new name for the Critics' Choice Awards. If it has the word gold in it, bonus, but I would like to hear it. Katie, where can they send those?
Yeah, text us at 213-513-7180 and tell us your ideas. Last question that is more of an existential thing for us than even our listeners. But in Anthony's piece, there are people just being like, you know, there's going to be just money lost in terms of events around the Golden Globes. And like people hold their parties for Golden Globes week. And there's all this advertising that goes into it. And there is a speculation that, you know, after this year of COVID, where we've learned to like go without stuff, that all of that stuff could go away. And I might be naive because this is, you know, part of my living as well. I don't feel like it's going to collapse that much because people still are willing to, you know, spend and be part of this circus. But do you guys think that it's a kind of a broader threat than just NBC's rating and the Globes themselves?
In terms of money loss, like I had bought a bunch of watches to send to the HFPA because I've been trying to get Sharon Stone a nomination for something.
Yeah.
And now I don't know what to do with all these watches. If you guys
want one,
let me know.
Send them to us, the voting members of the Critics' Choice Awards.
I mean, I think that is such a big thing, though, is that the ancillary economy around all of this, parties, brand deals, all that stuff, you know, people wearing certain designers' dresses on the red carpet and then talking about it to Juliana Rancic. Like, there's so much economy around this that isn't directly financially related to, let's say, the Golden Globes, but like is like it is a sustaining part of Hollywood's livelihood and our livelihood in terms of FYC ads and coverage and all that stuff. And yeah, and I think that in that way, the Globes going away and NBC or whoever struggling to find a replacement for it, like, is threatening to that system, as toxic as aspects of that system might be. So I think it actually is more serious in those terms than maybe, you know, the sort of Tom Cruise giving his Globes back. Did we remember he had them? No, I didn't. Like that, it seems kind of silly and sort of who cares, but actually there are material effects of this outside of the HFPA that are worth bearing in mind, I guess, in the future.
Well, and I think that's why we're talking about some other awards sort of sliding into that spot, hopefully, rather than just eliminating that part of the whole ecosystem entirely. And really, honestly, truly, I could not handle more mail coming to my house. So I would not want to be like in the HFPA like bribe spot. But
they just deliver it to you on the private jet they send to pick you up on your way to Paris.
I can have these watches on a plane this afternoon.
But yeah, I mean, I think that there's a way to shuffle the deck a little bit so that I agree with you, though, Richard. Like, we know a lot about, you know, the economy that exists
around. The sort of mother courage is dragging their wagons through award season, you know, selling their wares. Like, it's a big thing.
Yeah. And we know a lot more about it because of the Oscars and, like, Vanity Fair's relationship with that. Like, we are aware of that ecosystem. And so, like, I hope that... I hope that there's like a shuffling of the deck, but it might mean tightening up the award season a little bit. And I don't think that is given the change in interest around the award season that we've seen from like ratings. Because, you know, I don't think NBC would have pulled the Golden Globes as quickly as they did if it like the ratings weren't also declining for the Golden Globes, you know. Yep. So I think this idea of maybe giving us like a tighter, more electric award season might be in order.
Well, it's a reminder that in the way we talk about awards, even on this show, it's like, well, this is what's always happened. So this is what happened. Like, this is what the Academy likes to do. This is how award season narratives build. And we watched this past year a lot of that stuff change. And a lot of the things that we thought had to happen because they always did happen don't have to happen. And I think we're going to continue to see some rethinking along those lines. And in the case of the Golden Globes, I think it's going to be largely for the better. Maybe there's some stuff that we'll miss. But, you know, the reshuffling of things in the pandemic is continuing and will continue, I think.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jessie Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's greatest controversies. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when their adoring fans learned about the infamous lip-syncing, their downfall was swift and brutal. With exclusive interviews from frontman Fab Morvan and his producers Frank Farian and Ingrid Segeith, this podcast takes a fresh look at the exploitation of two young Black artists. Binge all episodes of Blame It on the Fame, Milli Vanilli, ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.
Okay, now we're here for, I think the first time in a long time, we've just like done a review segment in some ways about a new release because, you know, we had our Oscar movies and we just talked about them for 6 months and now we have new
six
stuff.
Months.
Oh, God. And that was
eight
the best.
Months, 9 months.
So we want to talk about The Woman in the Window, which is a it's new on Netflix as of Friday. It stars Amy Adams in a very large ensemble cast. It's directed by Joe Wright, who, as listeners of the show know, I tend to adore. It was going to be a Fox release. God, was it even made when it was still 20th Century Fox before it became 20th? This movie's been around for a while. And then was sold by Disney, which now owns Fox, to Netflix due to the pandemic. And Bobby, I wanted to throw to you first because, as I said, it was kind of obvious that we wanted to have you on the show. But, you know, as someone who doesn't necessarily see every possibly misbegotten prestige movie to land on Netflix, why was this one so in your sights?
This one was in my sights because beyond just the Amy Adams of it all, it was a book that I read and despised from like page one to page 400 or whatever. Like I think I read it in two sittings and was just so angry about it. I think I complained to people about it at the time. I was like, I just read the worst book over the weekend and I couldn't put it down, but I hated every page of it. It's definitely going to be a movie. Oh my God. And then of course all the stuff with Daniel Mallory, AJ Finn's the pen name for the author. And then everything surrounding his whole outing in the New Yorker of making up a lot of things about his past, like everything about the formation of this book as this kind of reverse engineered response to the woman and the girl on the literary thriller genre was kind of fascinating to me. Like it was like, oh, he's a book editor. He knew what worked. This is sort of like this algorithmically created book based on trends in the publishing world. Like everything about it was so annoying, but at the same time, like really compelling. And I hated the book so much that when I saw that it was being made by Joe Wright and starring Amy Adams and Julianne Moore, I thought, oh, wow, this is actually going to be kind of a Girl on the Train thing, which, I mean, I love the book and the movie Gone Girl. You know, I think a lot of people who are fans of that genre of book, I don't really read a lot of thrillers and mystery novels, but I know a lot of people who do kind of don't like that book. I completely fell for it. I love the movie as well. I think they're both excellent. I do not like the book Girl on the Train, but I thought the movie was a lot of fun. And I thought it was going to be a situation like that, where this movie was just finding itself in this kind of fun position of taking a piece of garbage and having fun with it and taking what works from this book and, you know, leaning into the star power and the creative power behind it. And I thought, you know, if anyone's going to make this movie worth watching, it's Amy Adams. She did seem to be well cast when I first, you know, saw the photo of her in the window and then the other photo of her in the window and then another photo of her in the window. I was like, you know what? Fine. And the original trailer, which I just looked up, came out in December of 2019, the original trailer for this movie. Like, remember December of 2019?
It was like 3 months silly. Ago. Yeah.
It was silly. It was over the top, like the reveal that Jennifer Jason Leigh is Julianne Moore, and you have the weird sort of like vibrating strings when Amy Adams' face is turning at her astonishment. Like, I was like, this is going to be a lot of fun. And then, of course, the pandemic pushed it, and it just became this impossible movie. So it's sort of like the legend of this movie only grew over the past year because it was supposed to come out May last year. And then, of course, the pandemic stopped it. Netflix takes the rights to it. And it was like, when is this movie going to come out? And I couldn't tell whether or not they were holding it because it was good or holding it because it was bad. Because a movie about an agoraphobe who can't leave her house seems like the perfect thing to release on VOD in the middle, if not sort of the late middle stage of the pandemic. Like,
or like May 2020, right? Like, that was what I was hoping would happen back then.
Just do it. And now, having seen it, I was absolutely blown away by the fact that no, this movie sucks. This is terrible. And I was texting about this with Richard last night. I was like, I don't know what camp I'm in. Would this have done better in the heart of last summer? Would people have been more forgiving? Would it have kind of been buried and forgotten? I feel like it has more eyes on it now. Like, more people are going to know how bad this is, and they're going to be less forgiving. So, like, I don't know where I stand on what the correct strategy was here, but I, other than the fact that the correct strategy was not to make it, you know?
Well, I think that I'm glad you put it in the context of Girl on the Train and Gone Girl, because so much of what's wrong, I haven't read the book, but so much of what's wrong about the movie, at least having read about the book, is that, like, the book is a Xerox of a Xerox is just, you know, hitting the beats hit by, like, Gone Girl and then everything subsequent to that. But trying to dress up this pale, pale imitator with all these prestige trappings, with a Tracy Letts script, and, you know, yes, Joe Wright shot it, but then Tony Gilroy was brought in by Scott Rudin to do massive reshoots. Mm. The rumor is that there were bad test screenings after the Joe Wright edit. There were bad test screenings after the Gilroy edit. It was kind of a lost cause no matter what. It's like, you can't polish a turd, you know? Like, they're just, it seems to, watching this movie, it's like, I think something at the heart of this was fundamentally bad, and there wasn't really any way to dress that up. I think you're right, Bobby, that the delays and all that, only maybe this is a narrow subset of people, but it's a, you know, it's not insignificant number of people who were waiting on this movie as like the big star-studded thriller savior of last spring or this spring.
Yeah,
it's like that mythos harms it all the more, you know, because it just comes with all this expectation. If this was just dumped unceremoniously on VOD somewhere in the last year with little fanfare, people would have been like, oh, okay. But now it feels like it's arriving with a bit more consequence, and way more consequence than it can sustain, given how shoddily it's made.
I just wanted to circle back to the books one last time. Like, an important distinction between, like, Gone Girl and those two novels that followed it. I mean, there have been countless imitators of those books, but, like, those are the two highest profile ones. Like, Gone Girl, at its heart, is a movie that had a couple of, if not three or four, characters that it understood, and like really great characters with motivations you understood. There was how it all tied back into the recession. Like, the relationship between the two people at the heart of Gone Girl is so much more compelling than anything that happens in Woman in the Window. Like, nothing about the character of Anna Fox makes sense, is relatable, it's hard to empathize with her. And weirdly, it's easier in the book than it is in the movie. But I'm done. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask my theory is that Netflix might have delayed this because they didn't want to tank Amy Adams for Hillbilly Elegy. Like, they didn't want to put it out months before, but we can see how well that panned out.
And she won
them
the Oscar for it, so they were
Yeah, good strategy. Yeah. Go ahead, Joanna.
Oh, no, I mean, Katie and I were texting while we were watching this, and I'll point out some bright spots. Julianne Moore is great in her part.
One scene.
Okay.
I
wasn't going to spoil it as one scene, but yes, Julianne Moore is fantastic in her one scene. So if anything, fire it up to watch her in that one scene. It's like, that's the most I've enjoyed Julianne Moore in her performance in actually a good while. And there are some visuals that are kind of arresting, like some of the original Joe Wright sort of emerging through, I would expect, is arresting. But also, like, you just can't save this story, I think, no matter what, because, you know, every time there was a twist where I was just sort of like, what? Katie was like, yup, it's just like this in the book. she's like, I can only assure you that it's just this baffling in the book. And I was like, okay. So.
There's this part, I think this is visual, this in the trailer, where there's like a car crash in the middle of her living room and she's seeing, and it kind of gets surreal for a moment. And it's kind of at the service of a plot twist that is not really that useful or revealing, but it's striking. And there's this color that, you know, is used in the windows as like she's trapped within her own house, that you can see something that was happening there at some point. And I don't know what like Tracy Letts' original version of the script would have been, because like you were saying, Richard, like, I don't know that you could polish this story. But you get these glimpses of something that could have been better, even if I'm not sure this ever could have been a good movie.
Well, the car flipped over in snow that she's standing in her kitchen looking into, I guess, the dining room or something. And she sees this car accident that informs her past. That was the scene where, you know, sometimes you watch a movie and you kind of start to wonder, like, did the director do this whole movie because they had that picture in their mind and then just kind of reverse engineered everything else? Like,
yeah,
I feel like there were some style choices. I'm Katie on the opposite side of Joe Wright camp. I don't like really any of his movies except for maybe Hannah, and Darkest Hour is fine.
Ooh, I love Hannah.
But Hannah's great. But and this actually is probably most akin to Hannah of all of his other work. You know, aesthetically, I just don't know that his stylistic interests, I think they wander away from the story so far that it only highlights how thin the story is, you know. I feel like if a really solid B movie director had just taken this material and treated it as what it was, you could make something kind of taut and compelling about it. But with the high style and the low, you know, narrative, low text, it just makes it seem all the flimsier. And I think that that's a failure of, like I said, trying to make something that is a copy of a copy feel prestige-y and significant the way Gone Girl was. And I think that The Girl on the Train, which is not a great movie, but Tate Taylor and Emily Blunt, who's the star of that film, kind of knew what they had, and they treated it as what it was. They didn't try to dress it up, and I think that's the big failure in this movie's case.
I also think this film suffers not just in comparison to Gone Girl and Girl on the Train, but also Amy Adams and Sharp Objects doing like a much better, better version of this, like, through the fog of substance abuse, trying to solve a mystery character. And I love Sharp Objects. It's one of my favorite things that's happened on TV in the last few years. And, you know, it's chasing so many different rabbits and not catching any of them is what this movie is.
Well, we didn't even mention Rear Window, which I rewatched after having seen this, which, I mean, it references explicitly. And Joanna, you had the idea that Gary Oldman's white hair is a reference to Raymond Burr, who's like the suspected murderer in Rear Window. And my God, like, does it not do any favor? Because it has like classic film references, like sort of in the movie, and they're all over the book, and you know, the Julianne Moore character's named Jane Russell, but none of it serves itself well. And you watch Rear Window where you're just like, oh, like a character with a motivation and another one with a motivation and like a direction for the story to go, and like all of these really basic things that Woman in the Window is missing.
And something about the book that I kept waiting for, and I feel like I forgot to revisit the original trailer before this, but I think there is a shot in the original trailer of her chat room, because to go back to Amy Adams, it's one of the most kind of crucial things that happens in the novel is that she belongs to this agoraphobic chat room. And because she is a psychologist, she kind of spends her days off. She doesn't do anything all day. So in the novel, you see what she does all day, which is she's in this chat room and she tries to help people out. And it makes her, not that I don't want to get into the trap of saying that like every protagonist has to be like, well, I don't think that's true. But when you have Amy Adams, who, like, why not make her likable? And she's so unlikable as a character in this movie, and her performance isn't even that great to begin with. Like, it's almost like she doesn't have any idea what to do. But, like, a crucial, I think, element of her character is knowing that ultimately she's a good person. And if she is seeing things, if she is making up, if she is the killer, it's a factor of things beyond her control, because ultimately she is good. And you never get that sense in this movie. And in the book, it kind of reminds you, like, she's spending her time trying to help people who suffer from the same affliction she suffers from. And of course, in the book, one of the women that she is counseling throughout the entire novel, or most of the novel, ends up being the teen across the street, Ethan, pretending to be an agoraphobe. And he is, and it's also how he sort of sucks information out of her, and how he gets to know her, and how he knows all these things about her via these chat room relationships, these chats with her. And like, that's something that kept striking me throughout the movie. I was like, Anna Faulk seems terrible, just awful. And I don't remember that being a thing in the book. And yeah. And I felt bad for Amy Adams. I was like, oh, she's playing this wreck of a character. She can't even add anything remotely charming to her, or remotely, you know, likable. And again, that's annoying to say, but like, it's Amy Adams. Come on. She's Junebug. You
know? like the titular Junebug.
Well, I mean, the baby was Junebug, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I think her character in Sharp Objects really push the line of likability sometimes, you know, in a way that I found really interesting. And I think that that's something that has been interesting to explore. So I guess I don't feel like I needed her to be likable. I just needed her to be like, I need to be able to invest in her. And I couldn't invest in her because she didn't even seem like a real person, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So,
and if you want to watch a movie about an agoraphobe who loves chat rooms, just watch Sigourney Weaver in Copycat. You know?
Yeah.
We have that already.
So we have so many recommendations for everybody.
I know. Do a double feature of Peace Dragon and Copycat.
And Rear Window.
I do think, though, that, you know, on a more serious note, like, it's a weird comparison to make, maybe, but something about the Ben Affleck movie, The Way Back, that came out right before the pandemic last year, that bothered me was that, like many other stories about addiction, it tries to source that disease in an event. Mm-hmm. I won't spoil what it is in The Way Back. I guess I won't spoil what it is in this movie. And I find something about that sort of psychological mapping really kind of weak, and also borderline offensive. Like it sort of blames outside causes for what is ailing Amy Adams' character. And I think that is not a true understanding of agoraphobia, of anxiety disorders, of alcoholism. Like, and trying to sort of tie everything into this neat narrative bow that then is sort of by the end of the film untied, and we're supposed to think everything is not great but better. I think that's pretty thin in terms of a subtext or sort of deeper meaning of the movie. And to compare it to Gone Girl, like, those are really psychologically interesting characters, but what Gillian Flynn didn't do, or David Fincher didn't do, was try to explain that. And I guess I just wish that some of what was ailing the woman in the window was left a bit more of a mystery in the way that it is in real life. I think that, like, the way that this movie tries to kind of diagram everything and parse it out and really explain everything, it doesn't work, and it the movie could have been so much richer if it just let things kind of exist on their own terms.
Do you guys have any hopes for where Amy Adams goes from here? I feel like it's this and Hillbillyology, and then, I mean, even Vice felt like not quite what we want from her. She's into Rami Hansen later this year.
Please don't forget the Justice League Snyder cut.
I was going to kindly. She's fine in it. None of it's her fault. I don't know. I think all of us are kind of eternally pulling for Amy Adams, and yeah. I hope that she can. I mean, honestly, the Enchanted sequel seems fun.
Is the Enchanted sequel real? Is that real, or is that just a thing that's okay?
I'm looking at her IMDb.
The worst thing that Amy Adams could do is star in a movie adaptation of Dear Evan Hansen. So thankfully she's not. Oh, wait. No. I now see she is doing that. So that's a problem.
I heard from multiple people who could not believe how mean you were to Dear Evan Hansen, Richard. So you're really
terrible
leaning
show.
Into your...
Offensive, awful show.
Julianne Moore's also in it with her. It's the Woman in the Window reunion that America clamored for.
Waving through the woman in the window. That's all I know
about
it.
Thank you. I think Amy Adams does get to a spot in this movie where she's like decent. I do think that it's a bad performance in aggregate, but like it's not a total like embarrassment for her. I think the movie's failures kind of aren't fully on her shoulders. Yeah. I think the supporting cast, I think Brian Tyree Henry makes a lot out of a thin detective role.
Yeah.
Julianne Moore obviously is incredible in her one scene. I think the window's great. You know, I haven't seen that window in anything before. I think it's mostly a theater window. But no, I think there is value. Yeah.
Punch.
The house. Yeah. The house is like a really good performer.
There's one point where Julianne Moore's character's like stuck in this dump. And I was like, oh, this place is gorgeous.
Well, that's like the Anne Hathaway, Chiwetel Ejiofor lockdown movie where they're complaining and they're in like a 4-story with a huge backyard London townhouse. And you're like, fuck off.
Like, not to go back to the house, because I feel like we should be talking more specifically about the windows, but if we go back and look at the house in full, like, that was something that I kept, you know, cocking my head at and wondering, like, what the idea was. Richard, you mentioned something about, like, was Joe Wright's big idea just the car crash and the house? And, like, the movie somehow kind of, I don't want to say it looks cheap because I didn't think it looked cheap. And if anything, it looked very expensive because I was like, is this one gigantic set that they built? Because that is impressive. But I kept wondering, why aren't they doing anything with this? Like, there's nothing really interesting happening. Like, and I know he gets made fun of it. Up for it, but like the panic room, like CGI tracking shots that go through the house and through the, you know, the coffee decanter thing, like there was nothing visually interesting done with this, you know, physical house. The most interesting thing that was done visually was the car crash in the kitchen, and that was CGI. So I'm like, you have this practical set and it felt so wasted, and every time it was wasted yet again, I was just annoyed. I was like, this is a cool set and nothing is being done with it. And like, you made the rear window comparison, and like, that was, you know, famously one of the, I guess, the biggest set at the time ever constructed.
Yeah.
And like, it has this in its, you know, sights. It has this as something that it's, you know, kind of directly referencing, and it can't figure out how to reference it. You know, like, it can't figure out how to do it in a way that is compelling or unique. That was just a really, a lot of frustrating things about this movie.
It gilds the lily. You know, I think that like, the house and her environs that were in for the almost entirety of the movie shouldn't feel so surreal. Her psychological situation can feel surreal, but I think that Joe Wright just gussies everything up and it just completely removes us. It would be so much more bracing if he really, like you said, Bobby, like used that set and like, and we really felt like we were in that house. But when everything is color blocked and, you know, all these kind of elaborate images are happening, it just doesn't feel credible. I think, again, to reference Gone Girl, something that David Fincher does so brilliantly in that movie is, minus a few shots, it all feels kind of prosaic in a very carefully stylized way. You know, I mean, he's doing, there's a lot of work going into that movie, but yeah, it's not trying to distract us with fancy imagery, you know? And I don't know that the source material here could have supported a more spare telling, but like, they could have tried at least. And I think that would have been a better attempt.
Well, I think also the house, like, maybe the ceilings are so high in that house so that they can have that car crash scene. But like, the fact that the house feels so big and airy, you know, like, it's dark and it probably does not smell good in there. But like, it's so much space. Whereas in Rear Window, right, Jimmy Stewart's in this like very small apartment, and the space is all outside. And here you have her rattling around this huge thing. And I was just like, I don't feel the claustrophobia of her agoraphobia, if that makes sense. So, yeah.
I would have given anything for a comic relief neighbor, like in the window. There's so many of those.
Yes. Miss Lonely
Heart. Window. You can rent it on any platform of your choice. It's great.
Yeah, it's so good.
I don't think anyone said the word Wyatt Russell throughout this entire discussion. Interesting.
I do think that this movie does accurately, like, depict the horror of Wyatt Russell living in your basement.
I didn't watch Falcon and the Winter Soldier, but I feel like if you had, you were like primed for being like, oh my God, him. And I find Wyatt Russell likable, but in this movie, he's kind of a non-entity.
They don't do anything with the character. It's just kind of...
And yeah.
I will say, this movie is not entirely without merit. I did learn one thing from this movie, and it is, if I'm ever witnessing a murder through my digital camera, I should take a photo of it. I shouldn't just put it down. She takes so many photos and not of the murder.
And there's literally a line, did you take a photo? And she's like, oh, no.
No.
Jimmy Stewart took pictures, and he had film.
The Run Through with Vogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that.
We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Now we'll move to the interview portion of the episode. We're moving into Emmy season. We're going to have a lot of great conversations coming up with people who are starring in some of the biggest shows that are premiering now or are going to be in the running for Emmy consideration. So we're going to start with my conversation with Dan Stevens. He is on the sci-fi tinged Amazon series Solos. It is an anthology series, so all the episodes are really distinctly standalone. He's in the last one with Morgan Freeman, although he also has a brief appearance in an earlier one, which we'll get into. And we talk about sci-fi and the nature of humanity and the pandemic and making a show during the pandemic. It's a great conversation. I hope you enjoy it. So Solos is so clearly, you know, clearly in some ways and not in other ways, a pandemic era project. And it's just really interesting to me to think about someone like you who's an actor who relies on either being in front of an audience or on a set surrounded by people. When this project comes to you, where were you in your pandemic life? What were you kind of looking for either as a way to get out of this or maybe kind of deal with it through the work on this?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I had a very actorly start to my pandemic. I was all set to open a play on Broadway when Broadway was shut down. I mean, I was literally in a rehearsal in a Broadway theater when the producers came in and said, you know, this is going to go dark for a bit, and it turned out to be forever. You know, so that was a, you know, certainly as an actor, it was a distressing start. And you know, obviously a lot of questions over what was going to be possible going forward, whether in theater or in film. And you know, there was a lot of anxiety flying around. And I've been lucky enough to do, you know, a couple of projects during this time. But yeah, it was really, it gave me a lot of hope to see this one come along, because it was, as you say, so clearly born out of the limitations of you know, what we could do. You know, the idea of, I don't know, shooting a movie about two football teams or something is, you know, not very practical right now. You know, an episode that just really champions one or two performances. And also I felt thematically, you know, in the writing, there was so clearly some really deep dive thinking going on in terms of the questions that have been facing everybody during this time. So, you know, I think everybody at some point in this past year has had, you know, a pretty introspective moment, you know, looking at their past, at memories, and also a great deal of anxiety about the future, whether it's the near future or long term, and you know, where we're going both personally and as a human race. You know, and I think sort of taking stock of all that, and it really felt like a writer have, you know, taken some of those themes, some of the questions, and turned it into something as beautiful as this. And that felt very special to be a part of.
I've talked to a couple people who, you know, actors especially, who had those moments in the early days being like, am I ever going to work again? Like, is this going to just like completely change all the work we do? Did you, like, in those early weeks, especially being on Broadway, like really watching so much shutdown, did you have those moments of being like, what even is this job going to be in the future?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fairly ridiculous job at the best of times. And but definitely when a pandemic comes along, you just think, oh, I might have chosen the wrong profession here.
Too late to be an epidemiologist, I guess.
Exactly, yeah. It's like I could have done something practical. So there was a bit of that, you know, flying around. But as it turns out, you know, with people being stuck in their homes, there's been a great deal of demand for things to watch and enjoy and take our minds off some of the bigger problems. And so, you know, perhaps there is still a place for us. So, you know, it's been an interesting time just sort of coming to terms with lots of things, really. That definitely had a part to play.
Yeah. I was interested, I don't know where these projects lined up, but you had this film at Berlin, I'm Your Man, that's in German, and you're playing a robot, which is not really what Solos is about, but there's just, you know, this overlap in thinking about the future and thinking about tech and how these plays roles in that. Is that something that you have thought about, or is this a coincidence that these two things are happening around the same time?
No, definitely. I mean, they're definitely themes and questions that I've always been interested in. But I felt particularly this year, you know, if I was going to do something and step outside of this bubble and go out there and engage with you know, with something at work, that I would ideally like it to have, you know, these themes underlying and some of these questions. And yeah, weirdly, you know, I'm Your Man is there is a little bit of Solos sort of you know, thematically in there. It's sort of near future. You know, it's by and large the world that we live in, except that there are these sort of bespoke Android boyfriends that you can order.
Yeah.
And so I was playing one of those speaking German, which was, you know, equally surreal to setting foot on set with Morgan Freeman, I would say.
Well, is that, I mean, you say, especially now you want to do work that's kind of on those topics. Like, is that something you think this past year has changed in you in terms of what you look for and like in making something that either speaks to you or speaks to something broader? Like, would you have thought about it that way a year ago?
I mean, I think there's always a hope that some of the work, at least some of the work we do, has some sort of deeper meaning. And that's not to say I don't still enjoy reading and, you know, don't still have an ambition to do deeply silly things as well that have, you know, very little profundity to them. But I did feel this year, you know, like if I was going to travel across the world, that, you know, it should be something as thoughtful and beautiful as I'm Your Man in Germany. And also, you know, here, even just to sort of drive 20 minutes down the street. It was one of the few times I've been that far out of my house this year, you know, was to go and do this show.
Yeah.
And it felt, you know, it really did feel worthwhile. I think this whole series seems to engage with some big questions. And I found, you know, I found reading them and also playing them very, very moving.
Yeah, so, you know, stepping on the set with Morgan Freeman, going filming something in the COVID age, you know, when I've talked to actors, like some people find it very like intense where you're all kind of in there together. And I think some people have found it kind of isolating where after you wrap, you can't have a conversation because you have to go off into your own bubble. So how did that change, especially when you're on a set with just one other actor? Like, how does that change the entire dynamic you have there?
Yeah, there was definitely, you know, a different atmosphere. I mean, I would say there was a kind of triumphant spirit underlying everything as well. The fact that, you know, because of these strict protocols, because of the way it was put together, we were able to make something. And I think everybody, cast and crew, were very grateful. Back in, I think it was November, we shot this, you know, we were right in the thick of things. And, you know, everybody was so grateful to have something to just go to work for.
Yeah.
But the usual atmosphere, the usual part of your day where you're just sort of, you know, in between takes, you go to craft services and you just stand around and talk nonsense with people. All of that was gone, you know. Yeah. Even the craft services is gone. You have to, you know, you can't just
bring
go
your own
sort
granola
of,
bar.
You know, yeah, there's no finger buffet in these times. But yeah, so, you know, a little bit of this sort of, you know, the fun element of the day-to-day, you know, working experience was absent. But I would say that, you know, it was almost replaced by this sense of, you know, that we were really pulling together and making something happen despite all of the limitations. And that was cool to feel.
Yeah. And, you know, that feeling I think can exist on like a really big project where you've got like hundreds and hundreds of crew people around you and, you know, you're in front of the camera, you got to get it right. Or, you know, I think about something like Her Smell, where it's a tiny film, but you have like all of that spirit of bringing something together. So it's nice to think that there, you know, something as big as a pandemic has the power to unite people and, you know, hopefully not put too much pressure on you as the person who has to get the take right and get everybody out there.
Yeah, I mean, there is that feeling to a lot of filmmaking, I find, you know, when you, it's just a big team pulling together to do something crazy and that spirit is often there. But I felt it was a sort of an added layer of something where, even though we're all behind masks and visors and stuff, that, you know, that we were able to make this happen.
Yeah. So, you know, you'd been in Broadway rehearsals, so that idea of like having emotional intensity within a really confined story is obviously very present for you. But what's so remarkable about this, you know, episode of Solos is you've got this character who's going to be fully built. You've got to reach a lot of emotional highs in a pretty short period of time. And it's not like you haven't been in the previous six episodes to build up to that. So what's the, you know, do you sit down with the script and kind of map it out for yourself? What do you do to kind of get to those places that you need to go in a pretty short period of time?
It's a good question. And I wish I knew the answer, because then it would be so much easier. But I think a lot of it was just giving yourself over to the writing, really. And it was something that Morgan was very clearly doing himself, was just sort of allowing the rhythms of the scene, you know, and the scene was 36 pages, you know, so that it really went places. And, you know, the writing was so strong and so structured that, you just sort of gave yourself over to it. And there's a huge amount of conflicting things going on in our particular episode, where you have this character Otto who's been searching his whole life for this thing that Stuart, Morgan Freeman's character, is in possession of, and mm-hmm. and so there's the culmination of an exhausting and emotional journey, but also a great sense of relief and triumph, but also this sort of resentment of this man who has this thing, and then, you know, a very, very emotional, revisiting of certain things. I don't want to give too much away.
You're getting really good at this, by the way.
I'm trying to speak in sort of abstracted off terms that I'm not.
The spoiler rules are very intense, and you're doing a really good job.
They really are. And I'm still getting my head around it myself. But, but you know, there was a lot to play with there. You know, it wasn't just sort of two people at a bus stop talking. You know, it was so much more than that. So I sort of followed Morgan's lead, and just sort of gave myself over to the rhythm of the writing, really, I think.
Now, I don't know if this is a spoiler too, and I think I have this right, that you are a voice in the other episode with Helen Mirren. Did I read the credits correctly? Okay.
Yes, yeah.
So how does that, I mean, again, not to spoil anything, but like, how does that work with the story that you're playing in this episode? Or, you know, just how did that work in terms of having a separate performance, really?
Yeah, I need to watch every episode quite closely to figure out if there is any real link between Otto and
I didn't see one, but I was wondering.
I didn't either.
One. Okay, okay.
And I think it was sort of coincidence, really. Okay. And I just, you know, I happened to have done this, the voice of the computer for Helen's episode, and that in a way was a good primer, just in terms of familiarizing myself with David's writing, really, and mm-hmm. watching Helen play again with the nuances and rhythms of her particular monologue, and getting to watch her up close was special anyway, and then to get to go and actually sort of be in person with Morgan was, you know, just an incredible bonus, I suppose.
Yeah, so how did that work? So were you watching her performance on video link? Well, how did that work together?
Yeah, I was actually live in the studio in a heavily protected sort of
little box
booth. So I was able to sort of interact with her, you know, as this computer might. But I think we maybe saw each other in person once or twice, the whole time we were filming, again, because of the protocols and whatever. But we sort of waved hi from a distance and that kind of thing. But it was a very different working experience to doing the episode with Morgan.
Yeah, no, I know movies can be weird like that sometimes too, where like you have one scene, you know, like presumably there's people on Eurovision you never cross paths with, but like this is such an intense version of that where you're like being deliberately kept apart from each other. You have to stage a premiere at some point or something like that. You were talking earlier about wanting to get back to doing something silly, and it made me think of Eurovision because, you know, thinking of like ways that people have escaped in the pandemic, like there is really no better example of it than Eurovision to me, I think. Like, it was such a huge phenomenon over the summer. Like, how much of that did you witness or become aware of as it became like the pandemic escape of choice?
Yeah, it was bittersweet in a way, because, you know, it was, I suppose when all said and done, it was a really lovely thing to have come out when it did. I think in sort of June, you know, people were pretty ground down, and there wasn't the usual sort of full of the joys of summer kind of feeling that, you know, it was bleak for a lot of people. And so, yeah, to have something that was so sort of unbridled and sort of joyous and silly and just fun. You know, we could never have predicted that, you know, that the thirst that people would have for something like that at the time it did. And it's been lovely. The feedback has been amazing. And obviously, you know, the ego wishes that you could get your red carpet moment or whatever and go and meet the fans or whatever it is. And I think there was a plan to have some kind of presence at the Eurovision Song Contest itself, which would have obviously been incredible. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's, you know, we're making entertainment for people to enjoy in whatever way they can, and especially at the moment. And so it was, it was really, it's a lovely thing to have out there. And I know people are still enjoying it, and the music is incredible.
Yeah, did you see Husovic performed at the Oscars?
Oh, amazing.
It was amazing. And it's something they couldn't have done at the regular Oscars. So it's like they took advantage of the format and like did something different. I was
Icelandic children in fishing jumpers.
I know.
It gets me every time.
I know. Honestly, I've listened to that song on Spotify and been like, why am I emotionally affected by this?
It's a beautiful, beautiful song. Yeah.
I mean, it's been interesting watching, you know, it's been like about kind of 10 years since you have this like big breakout moment, and you have really hopped genres and done things. And, you know, to me, it seems like a deliberate way. I think a lot of times actors say it's not deliberate. It's what the work that comes to you. But it makes me wonder if after Eurovision, people are like, oh, well, let me offer you some silly comedies, or after Solos, people want to put you into sci-fi. Like, are you watching the options kind of change of what's presented to you as you do all of these different things to kind of, I mean, in some ways show your range? Like, I don't know if that's the goal, but that's the effect it has.
Yeah, part of it's sort of showing range, part of it's feeling it as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't have a sort of conventional training, so a lot of my education has been on the job. And it's like, well, I want to try doing this. I want to see if I can do this. And I knew that I love comedy, and I used to do more of it, and it was great to sort of feel like I was getting back into that. And there's definitely more comedy down the line for sure. Yeah, it's lovely. You know, some of these things, some of them hit, some of them don't. But, you know, for me, it's all an experience. I learn something on everything I do. I love just the shape that things are becoming.
How long did it take to get to that position being like, well, some of it hits and some of it doesn't, but I've learned it. Like, does it take a while to get used to that when, you know, when you've invested so much into something and it may or may not be received the way you want it to be?
Yeah, it's just, you know, I've tried to sort of feel that there's a reason for everything I do, and try and find the lesson in everything, is, you know, and yeah, if something doesn't work for whatever reason, you know, I know in my heart of hearts why I wanted to do it. And very often there's something I can take away from it, you know, even if it's not some giant box office success, you know, there's, you know, it might just friendship or a working relationship or just knowledge that I can try something different is very valuable to me.
Yeah. I mean, what have we all taken from the last year, if not to like take what you can from an experience and not want things to go as planned, because they may never go as planned.
It's often different to what you think it will be.
So for Solos, for you, I mean, obviously with the spoilers trickery, especially around your role in it, like when you're telling people you know about it or telling people to watch it, like what's your pitch for it? Like, what do you think that either people you know or people who want to watch it like might find in it, even if you can't really describe what it's about?
I think, you know, it's, for me, it's about seeing, you know, a great writer like David take some of these big questions, some of these big themes, and finding a character to fit maybe one of those questions, and just running down the field and giving a great actor an opportunity to really go to town and have a lot of fun. And I've found, you know, every episode that I've seen incredibly moving, you know, and I think that's very rare, that you get a sort of an anthology show where each episode is quite so moving on its own merit, really.
Yeah.
There's some fantastic performances and just in half an hour, some really sort of deep dive emotional journeys that you can go on with this show.
There's something about just getting to see all those faces in close up for so long. And in every episode, you just get all this time to linger on what they can do. And I imagine if you're an actor, aspiring actor, you can just learn so much from spending that time with the face and what they can do with it in those spaces.
Yeah, very much. Yeah. And it's a really interesting group of actors, and they're all fantastic. It's you know, a real treat to watch.
We'll get you guys back together for like an ensemble, like Glengarry Glen Ross or something where you're all in a room shouting at each other. I have a last question before I run out of time. And we've been doing this rolling series of book recommendations on VF.com. So if you have read anything recently that you would like to recommend, I would love to hear it and share it with people. Have you read anything good lately?
That is a great question. One of the books that I enjoyed most this past year is a novel called Threshold by an Irish writer called Rob Doyle.
Okay.
That is a sort of a wandering novel around Europe, a sort of a young man coming to terms with a lot of things. And really enjoyed that.
That sounds great. Yeah, it's been really fun asking these questions because everyone has something to recommend and like wants to not talk about themselves for a second and recommend a book. So yeah, it's really nice.
And it's been a great year for reading.
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah. I have really gotten it back together after a long time of watching TV instead. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me for the book recommendation. And congratulations on the show.
Thank you very much.
That does it for this week's show. You can find us at VanityFair.com, including coverage of the ongoing Golden Globes fallout. And Richard, are you reviewing Woman in the Window?
Sure am. Yeah, I should be writing it right now, but I'm not.
Read Richard's review of Woman in the Window as well. You can find us on Twitter at Little Gold Men. And on our own, I'm at Katie Rich. And Richard.
Rylos.
And Joanna.
I wrote this.
And Bobby, where can people find you on Twitter or elsewhere?
At Bobby Finger and also at Who Weekly, the podcast I co-host.
Excellent. This episode was edited and produced by Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the best description of reading any magazine that is not Vanity Fair goes to Bobby Finger.
I couldn't put it down, but I hated every page of it.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts. From PRX.